You're listening to Holder Tonight with Peter Anthony Holder on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800.
Peter Anthony Holder here with you on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800. And this is indeed Holder Tonight, heard Monday through Friday until 10. Still to come, CJAD meteorologist Ed Cowell will tell us exactly what a meteorologist does and how one becomes a meteorologist. No dartboards are involved, I understand. It's all very scientific. We'll find out just all about it a little later on here on CJAD. But first, we have a return guest. Steve Kettman is on the program with us. He is the author of One Day at Fenway. And he's also involved in another book, which we'll get to later. One Day at Fenway, we had him on the air. It was early October, before the Boston Red Sox won the World Series. So he just must be giddy now. Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure.
I do want to talk about that other book, and we'll get to that in a bit.
We'll have time for that.
Oh, we'll have time for that. But let's bring us up to date with One Day at Fenway, which, for those who don't remember when you were on the program with us before, you went to, you and I guess a team of people.
Yeah.
Right? Went to Fenway Park, I believe it was August the 30th. Was that the date?
Yeah, it was August 30, 2003, which already seems like a long, long time ago.
Yeah, back then here in Montreal we had a team.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so you went with a whole bunch of people and you covered that day from every aspect and put out the book One Day at Fenway. Now, bring us up to today. I mean, the fact that here you are with a book that looks back at a team that just won the World Series. What are the odds? Because with their history, I'm sure you didn't think that was going to happen.
Well, I actually sort of predicted it in the book. And we did talk about that a little in the last interview. I hedged my bet, though. I'm not that foolish. But I had been around the team a lot. And one aspect of the project is I was really lucky. The Red Sox and the Yankees, to a lesser extent, were very generous in terms of giving me access. So, for example, on August 30, 2003, I watched a significant portion of the game with John Henry, the owner of the team, and Larry Lucchino, the president, alone up in Henry's box. And I had a number of private conversations. And you get that kind of access. You kind of feel like you're getting a glimpse of, maybe a little bit more of a glimpse of what these people are like. And I actually was there later that year, October 2003, after the Aaron Boone homer. Mm-hmm. I was at Yankee Stadium that night. And I went down, and I was in the Red Sox clubhouse afterwards. And, I mean, anyone who's followed the Sox remembers that game. Anyone who follows baseball remembers that game, because it was such a devastating loss for the Red Sox. And, you know, you had guys crying. You had that heaviness in the air when everyone was just right on the edge of crying, even if they weren't. And I watched John Henry go around the room from guy to guy. And he, you know, he's a very awkward fellow, you know, John. He's not a real gregarious sort, but yet he was putting himself out to go around player to player and thank them and then talk about next year. And I saw something in that impressed me. And so I went out on a limb and said that under John Henry, they would end the curse. So I gave myself a little wiggle room, but I basically said some year soon that they were going to do it.
Now, I would assume with all that's taken place and the fact that the book is out, you probably can be canonized in Beantown, can't you?
I made a few friends, I think, yeah. But one of whom is Pete Farrelly, who we should talk about.
Right.
Yeah. What I did was, for the book, I had more than a dozen reporters following different people around for the day. Obvious people like John Henry, or I talked to Joe Torre, you know, I talked to players. But then it just so happened that Spike Lee and Peter Farrelly, both directors, were there that day, each of them with their young son.
Were they together, or?
No, they were on opposite sides. They know each other, though, from Martha's Vineyard. They're friends there in the, you know, during the summer months, but not
buddies. I don't see Spike as a Martha's Vineyard kind of guy.
Well, I never would have either. When he was in college, he had never even heard of it, you know, and then he went up there, and I think his family, his kids really enjoy it. And so he has a house there, and he's been going there every summer for, wow, I think a good 10 years by now.
Okay. So anyway, you met up with Peter Farrelly.
Yeah, and so Farrelly was there at this game with his young son Bob, taking him to his first game at Fenway. And I kind of, you know, when you're working on a project like this, you kind of fall in love with certain stories. And I love that. Spike was there with his son Jackson, and so I just love the father-son thing. And so Pete Farrelly and I exchanged a lot of emails. Well, it turned out that as this was all happening, he was working on his next movie, which was all about the Red Sox. It was from the Nick Hornby book, Fever Pitch.
Right.
And I was there on the set when they were filming it, I mean, just one night. But that's the movie that's now appearing in theaters. I know it's opening here in New York tomorrow. I don't know about there in Montreal.
It's opening here as well. It's the Drew Barrymore film?
Yeah. Drew Barrymore is one of the stars, and Jimmy Fallon. Not my favorite actor, but but they had a lot of fun with the Sox stuff. So I've seen it. I saw it out in L.A. That Pete Farrelly hooked me up to see it, and I don't know. I liked it a lot, and I think people will enjoy it.
And they had to change the ending, right?
Yeah, exactly. They were all ready to do a doom and gloom, there's no pain like the pain of a Red Sox ending. And then they couldn't very well do that when the Red Sox won.
Now, you've been, obviously, to a lot of major league parks.
Yeah.
What makes Fenway special? And I'm familiar with it, too, because I'm a big Fenway fan, and I've been there several times. What makes it special?
Well, if I can give a little bit of a local contrast.
Yeah.
You know, one time when I used to cover the Oakland A's for the San Francisco Chronicle for about 4 or 5 years, so obviously I went to all the American League parks, and then I took a leave, and I spent about 2 months driving all over North America going to ballparks I hadn't been to. And so I flew up to Montreal and went to the ballpark, and I loved the fans there, but there were only about 6,000 of them. And, you know, big plays, airy. There was this sense of like, I don't know, it was like a machine that couldn't be operated because there just wasn't enough mass. You know, the critical mass wasn't there. And that's one thing about Fenway. I mean, everyone talks about the history and, you know, that's great. But because Fenway is a smaller ballpark, it's always full. I mean, in recent years, it's full. And every one of those seats, even if it's got an obstructed view, they feel special just for being there. And they're having the time of their lives, even in these new seats that they put in left field and in right field. And that's the thing I noticed. I mean, it's just such a excitement about being there. And when I was a sports writer traveling from city to city, I tell you, you noticed it immediately. There was a big jump in energy there.
There's also a knowledge and a friendliness about the fans of Fenway. I remember the first time I went there, I was supposed to go with a friend from Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't make it at the last minute. So I already purchased the ticket, so I went anyway. I drove down to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided, since I was going, I had these two tickets, that I was, for the Sunday game anyway, I was going to sell my ticket just at face value to somebody who was looking to buy a seat.
Uh-huh.
And pick somebody who, because obviously whoever it was I was going to be sitting next to. So pick somebody whom I thought would be an interesting character to sit beside.
Yeah.
And there was this gentleman who, this was in his 60s, and I said, I got a ticket. Would you like to buy it? Face value. He said, sure. So we went inside. Turns out this guy was from Pawtucket. So he knew all these players when they came up through the league.
Oh, wow.
And not only that, he started to tell me the story, and again, this is a man who's retired. He started to tell me the story of the first day he went to the ballpark with his dad.
Yeah.
And I thought, and it was like sitting beside the world's greatest color commentator.
Yeah.
And I watched the game. It was great. And I just found that was generally the way it was in Fenway. I would walk in there, and I was always wearing, I would wear a Boston Red Sox cap, which I always loved, but I always wore some Expo paraphernalia, so they knew where I was from.
Yeah.
And they were knowledgeable about the National League, knowledgeable about Montreal, which... I got to tell you, from a Canadian's point of view, when we find Americans who are knowledgeable about us, we love them to death. It's our inferiority complex. But it just seemed they knew what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of the whole thing. I mean, they're very smart, knowledgeable fans, and they study the subject. I mean, we talked last time I was on with you about just all the great books that have been written about, you know, Red Sox-themed books going back to David Halberstam, Roger Angel, who I had the honor and pleasure of working with on a book called Game Time. But so many great writers have dipped into the subject over the years, and they're literate fans. They pay attention. They spend the off season reading and talking to each other, and then when they're out there, they know what they're talking about. I think they're some of the smartest fans in baseball.
Absolutely. I'm also a person who sits in the stands with a scorecard, so I make new best friends anytime I sit at someplace like Fenway.
Well, everyone around you is doing the same thing, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, the book came out, as I said, we talked to you before, the World Series was won by the Red Sox. Now, of course, they are the World Series champs, the reigning champs. How has their winning of the World Series helped the book?
Oh, well, it helped, a ton. I mean, you know, after that, everyone in New England was kind of just going crazy and really through the holidays. Any book, you know, I was kind of, because my book had come out in August 2004, I was kind of the first, really, of a crop of Red Sox books. A lot of much bigger books, like the Stephen King book, for example, came along later, and then all of the books that came along once they'd won. But my book was kind of like first down the chute, so I got a nice little ride there for a while.
Is there any thoughts of recapturing and picking another day?
Well, the thing that always, you mentioned National League Baseball. I mean, I always have been drawn to doing the same kind of project in the National League because...
Now, please don't say Washington, please.
No.
Please.
No.
Thank you.
Definitely not.
Okay.
I wasn't even going to mention Washington in this conversation. You brought it up.
Okay.
No, but I used to know Dusty Baker in the, you know, the Bay Area in California, and like that's one thing I've thought about is doing like a one day at Wrigley where, you know, just a real good game where I could, you know, really kind of bring alive what Dusty Baker goes through. Because, I mean, it is so interesting managing NL style versus AL style.
Well, you know, I'm sure the Cubs and their fans would probably think that you brought good luck to the Red Sox. They'd probably invite you with open arms to Wrigley Field.
I'd like to think so. Yeah.
We are talking with Steve Kettman here on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJD800. He is the author of One Day at Fenway. By the way, you can check out his website, which is www.kettman.com. That's K-E-T-T-M-A-N-N, K-E-T-T-M-A-N-N.com. There's also another book I want to get to, and another topic that deals with baseball. We'll take a quick break. We'll continue talking with Steve Kettman here on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJD800.
You're listening to Holder Tonight with Peter Anthony Holder on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800.
Peter Anthony Holder here with you on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800, and this is indeed Holder Tonight, heard Monday through Friday until 10, right here on CJAD. We are talking with Steve Kettman. He is the author of One Day at Fenway, which is doing very, very well. How well has it been doing, by the way, Steve?
Well, not as much lately, but it did very well through the holidays, and I haven't even gotten the latest numbers or anything like that, but we definitely exceeded expectations, and then come August, it'll be out in paperback, so we think it'll get a nice ride then also.
Excellent. Now, you've also been involved in writing another book.
Yes.
You are the ghostwriter on Jose Canseco's book, Juiced.
Yes.
Which is interesting, because you mentioned the fact that you were, for years, covering the Bay Area, and obviously he was one of the Bash brothers.
Yeah.
Back then. So you've followed his career, and how did the two guys hook up? And the reason why I ask that is because you have written in the past about steroid use.
I have, quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
For example, I wrote an article. Well, let me backtrack just a little bit. I don't know if we discussed it before, but I actually lived in Berlin, Germany, from 1999 to 2003. And I wrote for a lot of different magazines and newspapers there. And they were having a trial there of Manfred Ewald, who had been the head of the whole East German sports machine. And that was a big deal there. It went on for months and months, and all these different women came forward and testified, including someone who had competed as Heidi Krieger, as a shot putter for East Germany. And Heidi Krieger got really big on steroids and ended up just kind of going, having some issues, and ended up having a sex change.
Wow.
And then came and testified at the trial as Andreas Krieger. And so I had to say, like, you know, I had known about steroids because I covered baseball from 94 to 98, and, you know, I was around when McGuire and Giambi were kind of buddy-buddy, and, you know, you never knew what you were seeing, really. And so any sports writer who didn't write about it back then, you know, it was a tough one for all of us. We didn't, you know, you knew what you knew, but, you know, how do you write about it? It was always kind of a difficult issue. But so when I was there in Berlin in 2000, writing about this trial, I have to say it really kind of shifted my perspective. I talked to a woman there, her name was Birgit Michel, who was another former athlete.
Right.
And I asked her what she thought about, you know, American athletes, baseball players, you know, North American athletes, baseball players, on steroids, and she, like, looked at me and gave me this whole talk about, you know, there are always going to be steroids in sports, but I would tell every athlete, you know, steroids are a time bomb. Never fool yourself about that. So it really kind of, you know, it kind of shifted my perspective on it.
So here we are years later. How did you hook up with having been someone who wrote about it, who covered it?
Yeah.
How did you end up hooking up with Jose Canseco?
Right. Well, okay, the story there is I moved from Berlin back to New York, and I do different work in publishing, you know, where I work on books.
Mm-hmm.
There's different roles that you do, but they call in people. And I had worked with Regan Books. That's the outfit under Judith Regan's leadership, and they're the ones who published Jose's book. So they knew me. I had worked with them, and they wanted to do the book. And then Canseco had submitted my name as one of about 10 or 20 writers that he would like to work with. Because I didn't cover him in his heyday with the A's. I covered 97,
okay.
When he, Act 2, when he came back, when
right.
He was nothing like his former self, really.
Right. So was this almost like too good to be true when, you know, with the knowledge you had on the issue at hand and the fact that, like, so many sports writers, and we can debate that forever as to why no one broke the story when everyone knew the story.
Yeah.
But was this like a kid in a candy store? It's like, oh, goody, I get to blow the lid on this one?
Not really. I can't say I ever took any pleasure in working on it in that sense. I mean, you know, like I was just talking about how taking steroids real seriously, and then in Juiced, Canseco's book, you know, the tone of the book is it's a pretty gleeful tone about steroids. I mean, he is 40 years old and looks pretty good, and I mean, he's kind of ridiculously large. Don't quote me on that, but, you know, I'm sure you saw him on one of his TV appearances, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just a real big guy.
A lot of material in those suits.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A lot of yardage there. But however, overall, I think he looks real good, and I think that there's really something to his arguments in general about how, as there's more research done about steroids, there's really been very little on humans so far. He's right about that. The top scientists will tell you as well that as far as double-blind studies, you know, on humans, about what steroids do to you over time, there's very little hard, you know, scientific research out there. And so it's going to be years before we really know. But I think that down the road, I do think that it's going to be much more typical that especially, you know, a certain kind of health-conscious person as they're getting into their 40s and 50s, you know, fitness-conscious, watching what they eat, and maybe just like guys, you know, 20 years ago or 5 years ago, guys popping Viagra would have seemed kind of strange, but I mean, it still does to me. But it's pretty widespread now, I gather, from the ads. And so I think there is something to that, that's how steroid use will be in the future.
Now, when the book first came out, there was no mention of Steve Kettman, the ghostwriter.
Yeah, I was in the acknowledgments, and you know, I could have, if I didn't want my name associated with the project, I just wouldn't have done that.
Okay.
But you know, it's very typical. A lot of books are written that way, where you have a ghost who his name isn't on the cover. And, you know, it wasn't something that I really thought twice about. It just seemed right, because no one cares about Steve Kettman.
But, you know,
not one person, not even my mother probably cares whether my name's on that book.
But you do have a name. People recognize you from all the sports writing you've done, and you have books on your own. And, you know, the internet is just a place where people get together and dish. And there was all this discussion is, who wrote Canseco's book? Who helped him? Who's the ghostwriter?
Yeah.
Who? And, you know, the name come out. It's like it's like a big game.
Yeah, well, and actually this is the first interview I've done about this. I don't know if you knew that, but this is the first time I've talked in public about this.
Have you had any reaction, one way or the other?
Well, the New Yorker did an article at one point, and Canseco, this was several weeks into the whole controversy, and Canseco came here to New York, and I have some friends at the New Yorker magazine, and one of them had mentioned to the writer that I was the ghost, and, you know, it was supposed to be kind of a, it was an open secret. I never kept it a real secret. I anyone could know, but I just never wanted to talk about it because I didn't want to be part of the story, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Just because why be involved? I mean, I'm just one cog in the machine. But so the New Yorker did this article where they asked Canseco if I was the ghost, and he said yeah. So they put it in the paper, and after that there was an article on the AP moved an article about it, and there were a lot of phone calls and everything. But it seemed kind of strange to me. It was kind of surreal.
Having seen firsthand what happened in Germany and having watched what has happened in baseball over the last little while, do you think in the grand scheme of things this is going to do major damage to the game?
Oh, no. Oh, no, no. Far from it. I think that, first of all, you know, I actually wrote, and frustrated writers, even published authors, write articles that never get published. And I, I submitted one to the New York Times about a month ago, before the hearings, to the op-ed section, the opinion section of the paper, saying that Bud Selig, the commissioner, is operating from a position of strength because baseball is doing great. You know, there were record-setting ticket sales in Arizona. You know, there's all these new sponsorships lining up. Baseball is doing great. But baseball is not hurting or sick because of steroids, I don't think. I think that the fans are pretty smart, and there might be a few isolated fans who are just shocked that all these guys could have been on steroids, where it really shifts their thinking or their emotional connection to their team. But I think they're in the minority. I think most people, you know, it's kind of one more thing that you add to your picture. You know, my brother lives in California, is a big San Francisco Giants fan. He loves Barry Bonds. And, you know, he's my brother, so obviously he and I have had a few conversations about performance enhancers. I myself do not know what Barry Bonds has done, but I'm saying in general, you know, I don't think there's any reason it needs to disillusion anyone at all. I think most people, and this is something that's in Ken Seiko's book, but I think most people, if presented with an incredible opportunity, especially if you come from a poor family where you could set up an entire extended family for years, just by, you know, helping yourself out with a little pill or a little shot, I think a lot of people would do that. I'm not saying I would. I don't think I would. But I think a lot of people would be tempted.
Isn't the danger, though, the fact that, aside from the fact that it's a national pastime, it really is a business, and people tend to forget that.
Yeah.
People tend to romanticize too much the fact that these are people who little kids look up to. And therein lies the problem more than anything
else. Yeah, no, I agree with that, definitely. I mean, that's why, I mean, I've done articles for national magazines on, you know, gays in sports, and I mean, I'm always interested in, I don't like the whole myth-making thing. I don't like the like trying to build these guys up into something. I mean, they're interesting because they do special things on the field, or, you know, or the court or whatever, or the ice, back when there used to be a sport called hockey, excuse me. But, you know, I mean, I think that I like the realist school of enjoying sports, and so, that's why I argue that this has all been good for baseball. And I know that probably sounds self-serving to some people since I was involved with Canseco's book. But to me, this got a lot of people talking about it. The U.S. Congress had hearings that I think most people agree would never have happened if not for the book. You know, that baseball's new testing policy already was changed because of those hearings. There was that whole clause about whether they'd have a 10-day suspension or a fine, and they took care of that. And I think we're going to see continued attention to this, and I think that's a good thing. And I don't think it needs to detract from the enjoyment of the game at all.
Well, it's a busy, busy time for Steve Kettman, both with One Day at Fenway, which is doing very well, and as you say, coming out in paperback in August?
Yeah.
And people can go to your website, www.kettman.com. That's K-E-T-T-M-A-N-N.com. And also, you're involved with the book Juiced, and that is still out there on the bestseller list.
Yep.
And doing well. And the game, at least in some areas, is back.
Yes.
So go out and enjoy baseball if you can. I thank you very, very much, Steve, for being on the program with us once again. What's up next for you?
Oh, I can't decide. I'm thinking about doing a Hedy Lamarr biography.
Hedy Lamarr?
Yeah. Do you know about her story?
Oh, yeah.
Well, she, in addition to having been the star of what some call the first nude scene in cinema, she went on to make an invention, which is the key to the technology of cell phones now.
She was a great businesswoman.
Yeah, well, she was very smart, but she never really got to do much with it.
And didn't she also sue, was it WordPerfect?
Corel.
Corel, yeah. Yeah,
she was living late in life. She was living in Florida with hardly any money at all.
Yeah.
And then Corel used her image for this software, thinking that she was long gone, and she sued and got about $5 million and spent her final days in a mansion down there from that settlement.
Well, again, I thank you, Steve, for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
Steve is the author of One Day at Fenway. That's Steve Kettman, and you can go to his website, www.kettman.com. News is next here on Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJD 800.